going to speak tonight about how human beings are creatures of hope and expectation, both materially and spiritually. But when you look at the facts, when you look at the data, it's clear human beings don't know what they want. The problem is not so much that they can't get what they want. The problem is they don't know what they want. Then when you look at hopes in terms of poverty, the hopes, the expectations, the longings play a very important and crucial role, and you're not disappointed. You may think that in living life, in this material world, the problem is you can't always get what you want. You see something, you hear about something, you touch something, you smell something, and then you have to evaluate. I know I want this, and I know it'll make me happy, but I just can't seem to get it. Such a situation produces frustration, anger, as you know from Bhagavad Gita, where Lord Krishna explains the process of material disruption. You first contemplate the objects of the senses, and then through that contemplation, you become attached. The sense objects enter into your consciousness. It's a two-way street that's going on, reciprocation between the senses and the sense objects. As pointed out by Uddhava in his questions to Lord Krishna in the 11th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, the sense objects are always lodging themselves in the mind, and the mind is always running out to the sense objects. So it's like a loop going on, birth after birth after birth. Therefore, Uddhava asks Krishna, how can self-realization be possible as long as this endless loop is going on between the senses and the sense objects? How can anyone ever be enlightened? Very, very important question. And Lord Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita, you contemplate the objects of the senses, attachment develops. That attachment means, as I said, the sense objects enter into your consciousness. They become lodged there. And then, of course, based on that attachment, there's lust. An inflamed, feverish state in which you just have to have what is lodged within your consciousness. The natural consequence of the contemplation, the attachment to lust, is anger, because even if you get what you're lusting after, you won't be satisfied. Therefore, you become frustrated and angry. Now, in this situation of a global economic meltdown, it's very interesting to analyze the general conceptions that people have. For so long, the economists have led the scene in analyzing human aspirations. They make it very clear for us. The prime base of decision-making is financial. As Prahlad Maharaj states in the 7th canto of Bhagavatam, money is the honey. You all have heard the expression that, well, money can't buy everything. But there's a second part to that mantra. Money can't buy everything, but what it can't buy, it can rent. So, for so long, this principle has been the basis upon which everyone expects everyone else to act. You're going to ask for your financial gain. That is going to be the basis of your decision. ready for so long. In fact, the operation of huge economies has been based on this principle that just let everyone act according to their financial self-interest, and somehow or other, it'll all work. The invisible hand of the marketplace. Everyone's wondering about that invisible hand. as you have to pay for the bonuses for all the great competent executives, financial executives. So that was the theory. You are a creature of economics. Yes, there are other things about you. You have physical and mental desires. But the bottom line is the money. You will base your decisions primarily, not ignoring the other aspects of you. You want to be healthy. You want to be liked. You want to love and be loved. You want to be appreciated. You want respect. All that is there. But the bottom line is a financial consideration. Therefore, especially since World War II, especially in Western societies, of course, the prime method of figuring out where people are at and what they're going to do is based on finances. Treating the human being as primarily an economic unit. Now, in the past 10 years, a new, according to the Western worldview, a new way of analyzing human behavior has emerged. And it's being accepted in economic circles, especially in this situation of financial meltdown. People are now open to thinking maybe there's another paradigm through which you can view human behavior and analyze how human beings make decisions. So now, the new thing is not so much that human beings make decisions based on finance as their mainstay, but human beings make decisions based on how much emotional bang they think they're going to get out of the decision. So this is a harder thing to analyze because people don't like to admit that I'm doing this because I want to feel good about myself and I want others to feel good about me and I want to feel good about them. In fact, some of you might be thinking, well, that's analyzing decisions in terms of emotional bank, that's a lady's thing, but for men, practical men, they're not influenced by that. But I must inform you that research doesn't bear that. Everyone makes a decision based on the emotional impact they expect in the future. Even when it comes to money, by getting this money, I'll feel better about myself. I'll feel more secure. I'll feel more respect. I'll feel a sense of achievement. So those things are the important things, not just the money itself. We've all heard in Krishna consciousness how we have imperfect senses. Generally, you think that means, well, I don't see everything that's going on in the world. I can't see like a cat. I don't see infrared. I don't hear what dogs hear, high frequency sounds. I can't see life on other planets. Although everywhere you can dig in the earth or go in the water, even in the most inhospitable, apparently inhospitable places you find life. So I don't see life on other planets. Must be because I have imperfect senses. Yes, I made a few mistakes in life. To be expected to err is human. So, the devotee can understand. I'm not seeing all that there is to be seen. I need the help of Krishna for extending my sense perception so that indeed I can verify the spiritual reality. We were speaking last night at Gaura Prem Prabhu's house. Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, Yaksha Abhagavam Tanyam Sasukam Dharmavya. This Raja Vijaya, this king of knowledge, gives direct perception of the self. Now Krishna doesn't say that Raja Vidya gives you a stack of religious beliefs that you're supposed to memorize and assimilate. No, Krishna says the Raja Vidya, the Raja Guya, and the perfection of all religion gives you direct perception of the self. Sukham Karthamadhyam, it's joyfully performed. This laboratory process of bhakti, in which you are given processes by the Supreme Personality of God, methodology you're given by Bhagavanji Krishna, the processes are all joyfully performed. So the bhakti yogi is a joyful science. Yes, bhakti yogi is science of a different type, and it deals with facts of a different type. Therefore, Krishna is inviting you to enter the bhakti laboratory, and there you'll get the results if you follow the instructions properly. Imperfect senses, however, play a bigger role in our life than we ordinarily would expect. And the latest scientific research shows you that, what you should have already known. In Bhagavad Gita, 16th chapter, Krishna says, Asha Pasha Chatire Pratam, the materialistic living entity who has forgotten Krishna, is bound by a network of false hopes. You've got to be a creature of hope. You know the expression, hope springs eternally in the bosom. You're always, I hope I can have this. I hope things will get better. Or I hope about this. I hope about that. And you engage in material activities based on hope. By my acting in this way, I'm going to get emotional bang. Not just the ladies, things like that. The men also. Just the men, they don't admit it. They just say, it's all business. It's all about money. It's all practicality. Got to add up, you know? Not true. Not true at all. What does it mean to be Asha Pasha, bound by false hopes? According to the latest research, human beings have extraordinary difficulty in properly estimating future emotional fulfillment. They're always wrong. That's what it means that you have imperfect senses. Not simply that, I can't see far in the mirror because I don't have my glasses on, or I'm not able to see the soul, even though I can intuit that I am a spiritual entity. I don't see that. And because I'm a spiritual entity, that I can intuit, therefore I can also intuit that there's a spiritual world besides the material world. So I don't see all that, but I can intuit. So I'm willing to accept that my sense perception without bhakti yoga is limited. But no, let's get at the root of our existence. At the root of our existence is hope, and it's a false hope because you can't properly predict your emotional future. You constantly make a mistake about how much emotional bang you're going to get by making a decision now. Not possible to properly foresee. This is called, in scientific lingo, impact bias. The bias means you have a tendency to err in terms of estimating the impact of future happy events or future painful events. So just think now about your decision-making process, and you'll see how Maya is at work. If I would get this, then I can just project right down to the future how I'll feel. I'll feel good. Whatever. Any kind of decision. Not just if I get this car, if I get a BMW. How am I going to feel driving up and down the Pacific Coast Highway? And more than getting a BMW, if the right person is in the car next to me, I know how I'll feel. I want to get more money, rest, I'll feel more secure, I'll get more respect. I can just see all that. It's just so clear. It's crystal clear. If I hook up with this person, or if I'm more respectable, if we form a legal union and have a respectable family life, I can very well perceive how I'm going to feel in the future. No. Wrong. The latest embarrassing research shows without a doubt that human beings have imperfect senses in this most fundamental way. They cannot properly predict the emotional impact they're going to get in the future by making a decision now. It's embarrassing, isn't it? And just seeing the nature of mind, that confidence is there in us, that yes, I know what I'm doing, I haven't experienced firsthand, I'm sure, I can make a proper decision about what's good for my future emotional fulfillment? No. Again and again, you overestimate the positive impact you're going to get. Not only that, but you also overestimate how much of the stressful event in the future will affect you. So you have this tendency that if I do this now, I'm going to feel so good in the future. You always overestimate. Not only that, if such and such a bad thing happens to me, if the wife suddenly leaves, or if my teenage son goes off the rails, oh, disaster. You also overestimate that. So there's something inbuilt. There's something that's in our Maya consciousness that doesn't allow us to see properly. So we just make all these decisions based on the emotional impact we're going to get in the future, and we're always wrong. Now you can start to understand more and more why Krishna said, Matva Svashastu Kaunteya Chitosha Sukadukada Thamsa Dikshastu Bharata. Krishna tells them that just tolerate all this coming and going of happiness and distress. Don't get caught up in it. Why should you get caught up in it? Because you can't properly predict how you're going to feel. So Krishna is saving you all the trouble. Krishna is saving you all the scientific research. And he's saying, look, just tolerate these comings and goings of happiness and distress. That's why Krishna chastises Arjuna and Bhagavad Gita. You don't want to fight, he says. You think you've got it all figured out, how you're going to feel if you engage in this battle. You're presenting to me that you don't see how there can be any happy outcome, whether you win or lose. You've got it all figured out. But I'm telling you, you just do your duty and tolerate the comings and goings of these perceptions. In other words, your perceptions are wrong. You don't know. You cannot properly perceive the emotional impact in the future of decisions that you make now. Arjuna tells Krishna, I don't know what's better, to be conquered by them or to conquer them. Either way, it looks like a complete loss. He's very emotional in that first chapter and a half of Bhagavad Gita. So much so, he's trembling. He's in a very distraught condition. He drops his bow, which were a Kshatriya. It's quite an extraordinary thing. Govindashtama fights. I have estimated what the emotional outcome of my decision to fight. I've estimated what emotional outcome that decision will bring. Doesn't look good. So the latest research will show that indeed Arjuna overestimated the emotional negatives. Just as someone will overestimate the positive emotional negatives. If you understand it, you'll save yourself so much trouble. Just watch yourself. Just catch yourself projecting into the future emotionally. Okay, I'll do this now. then I'll feel a certain way in the future. Again and again, human beings turn out to be wrong. So what is it in you that just constantly projects like that? Make a decision, you'll feel this way. Make a decision, you'll feel this way. That's why Krishna says, Asha, Pasha, Sutara, Bada, bound by a network of false hopes. It's the nature of the conditioned soul to keep projecting like this. And furthermore, even this mundane scientific research shows that after you get fooled one time, two times, three times, I'll just do this, and in the future I'm going to feel like that, you're unable to learn from each lesson. Embarrassing, isn't it? You think, well, last year I made a decision thinking what the emotional impact would be. Didn't happen that way. Totally overestimated. So, I won't do that again. No. You can't restrain yourself. This impact bias is built into the conditioned state. Just like there's something called adaptation that everyone knows. You get some new material experience. Very shortly, you become adapted to it. It fades into the routine background of your life. We're speaking material, whether it's marriage, a vacation, a holiday, a new home entertainment system, whatever. Very quickly, the adaptation sets in. Instead of that event being center stage in your life with bright lights shining on it, it just fades into the humdrum background. And then, if you really admire, you just keep looking for where's the next emotional explosion going to be. So, you would think it's possible to learn from that adaptation. That's it. I'm not going to fall for this again. What's the use in my endeavor? I'll just become accustomed to what I get. It'll fade into the background. It'll lose its luster. It'll turn out to be no big deal. You think you'll be able to learn? No, not possible. You do it again and again and again. This is how helpless living entities are in the hands of loose entities. So you can take note of this scientific research to see how indeed the conditioned soul is in such a powerless situation. Even if you know these things, you still can't sort yourself out. It's embarrassing. One of the top scientist who was very famous for this research. He gives his own self as an example. He says, I know all this stuff, adaptation, impact, bias. I know all that. But still, he gives himself as an example. He's a mountain climber. He makes a mistake that so many mountain climbers make, that, oh, I know it's getting to be dusk. I haven't gotten close to the peak of the mountain yet. Never mind that my water supply is not whole, my food supply is not whole. Never mind that I don't have enough food in case I don't make it to the mountaintop. I have to spend the night camping out. Just push ahead. In other words, he underestimates how he's going to feel in the future. It'll be all right. Yeah. I'll survive. And then doesn't get to the peak at the appropriate time, has to camp out and spend a half-frozen night with not enough food, shivering. And the guy says, I'll tell myself, never again, I'll never do this again. And again and again, I do it. Because I just don't estimate what the future feeling is going to be like. I don't estimate ahead that. Oh, you felt this way before. You understand you're going to be very hungry and cold if you don't turn back now? No, no, I'll just give it a go. The guy even pointed out that once he's an outdoorsman, world famous scientist. I love canoeing. I had a canoeing accident. Runaway canoe. I vowed I'll never touch another canoe again. gunamaya, mamamaya atirakya. It's something that has you in the grip. It's impossible for you to deal with. Krishna says, unless you do things in his way. Surrendering to Krishna means doing things Krishna's way. I think some of you may be intimidated, consciously or unconsciously, by the word surrender. It sounds like, you know, you're walking along the street, you know, 10 o'clock at night, and some mother jumps out from the shadows, or surrender your wallet, surrender your purse. So I think some of you think Krishna is saying like that when he says, abandon all your conceptions of what you think is Dharma and just surrender to him. You get this, you feel a little intimidated, like Krishna's trying to mug you or something, or take away what belongs to you. But if you look at surrender in terms of following Krishna's instructions, just like when you get some new consumer device, most persons will open the manual. That means surrender. I'm going to see what the directions say, what the user's guide says, and then I will act. Of course, those of you who are accomplished in dealing with gadgets, you may, you know, speculate at first, but that speculation is based on prior knowledge. I know IT persons, they rarely look at manuals because it's part of their pride that I'll just figure it out sooner or later. I don't need to look at the manual. It's just quicker than I speculate, correct myself. They get a bit of an ego boost that way. Yeah, the IT specialist here, though, they can verify. It's like a real delivery thing that consults the manual. It implies that you don't know what you're doing. But most people will consult the manual straight away. And that's all Krishna is asking you to do in Bhagavad Gita. Consult his directions, take his directions, and then you get a different result. That is surrender. That's all. In other words, accept that there is a standard plan for happiness. Now, just try to understand how some people have a problem with that. A standard plan for happiness? I mean, aren't we all just individuals? And we all are meant to just do our individual thing, and that way we get our individual type of happiness. Shouldn't life be that way? You got your vision of happiness. You got yours, and somehow it all works out. Everyone just pursuing their own particular flavor of happiness. Then you hear Krishna say, forget your individual tiny and imperfect speculations about happiness. There is a standard plan for happiness that is meant for everyone. You may be a little oppressed by that. Even you may come from a religious family where you offer, out of tradition, you offer respects to Krishna, you offer pranams, Jai Sri Krishna, Jai Bhagavan Sri Krishna. Well, then when it's time to make a decision about what to do, of course, you just do your own thing. So, the basic problem, the underlying problem is, how can there be a standard plan for happiness? Can Krishna have it all figured out for everyone? Someone who actually understands that Krishna indeed is capable of giving a standard plan, they make advancement in Bhakti Yoga. And those who have some conscious or unconscious doubts about that, they make some spiritual advances, but they have a difficult time getting on the motorway, getting on the freeway of Bhakti, which means to accept that Krishna's standard plan for happiness is the best. We don't have to manufacture our own plan for happiness. We can shut down that factory. Now that sounds a little difficult, to shut down your factory of making plans how to be happy. What are you going to do in life then? You can't make your own plans to be happy. What's the use of being alive? What's the use of being educated, being respectable? What's the use of all that? In other words, you want to feel that I've earned the right to make my own plans for happiness. I've shown my maturity. I've shown my expertise. I've shown my wisdom. Just look at my job. Just look at my family. Everyone knows what they're doing. My whole family, everyone knows what they're doing. All right, success. Then you look at the facts. We find out differently. We talked about the impact bias. How? You can't properly estimate the emotional future that you're making your present decisions about now. In practice, you can't estimate the happiness. You can't even estimate the distress. This is how foolish we are. For example, scientific research has shown that most people, when given a choice, they say, what do you want? Do you want a broken shoulder right now? Or would you rather have a knee that's a little, when you used to work for gimpy, or a little, when you have a knee that's bothering you all the time? Which one would you rather have? What do you think people say? The last thing I want is a broken shoulder, a broken bone. I don't mind a limb that's acting a little funny from time to time, maybe a little arthritic, or maybe it's just when you have, suppose you have ligament problems, things aren't just right, I can tolerate that, but a broken bone? But the research shows that people can't understand. They're more disturbed by some chronic ailment, like a strained ligament or a knee that's not just right. They're more disturbed by that. It's nagging. It's annoying. It goes on and on. You can't solve it. You go to doctor after doctor, chiropractor after chiropractor, and it's just not solved. Whereas when it comes to the so-called big distresses, there's a part of human psychology that puts up defenses when it comes to the death of a near and dear one, when it comes to a major disease. Human beings have this capacity to throw up defenses. Whereas when it comes to the little niggling things, the annoying things, they don't have that capacity to put up defenses, and therefore they underestimate how bothered and distressed they'll be by something that's just an ongoing chronic nag. For example, a man or a woman will say, oh, if there's divorce, it'll be a complete disaster. But I don't mind putting up with a partner who, just bugs me all the time. It's not like that. The research shows that actually, when it comes to like a sudden divorce or whatever, you can throw up emotional defenses against that and get yourself back together after a while. Although at the time it feels, I'll never get over this. Oh, my whole life is just blown to bits. But because you have this propensity, this human propensity to be able to muster up defenses, you get over it. Whereas an ongoing problem, he doesn't understand me. He doesn't listen to me. He doesn't even want to talk to me. That actually disturbs you more because you don't have the tendency to throw up defenses. And so therefore, you're hurt more by the impact. So just see all this illusion going on. And we think we're so confident. We think we're so expert. So I'm just telling you, Lord Krishna's teachings in Bhagavad Gita, and then I'm pointing out how scientific research verifies that. It's a real blow to our pride. It's a real blow to our false ego. There's one last thing. It's called empathy gap. Again and again, it's been shown by scientific research that human beings cannot, when they're in a cool-headed state, understand how they will act in a hot-headed state. They can't figure it out in advance. Just like you might think, well, I'm a cool-headed, level-headed person. I think things through clearly. But you cannot predict your response when you're in an agitated state of mind, an angry state of mind, a lusty state of mind. You can't predict now how you're going to act. In fact, the research has shown that greater than the differences between you and another person is the difference between you when you're in your cool-headed state and when you're in your hot-headed state. You can't properly anticipate how you're going to behave in an agitated state of mind due to anger, due to fear, extreme paranoia. state, based on how you feel when you're in your cool-headed state. Therefore, you see again and again, people make wrong choices. Because they don't know themselves. When Krishna says, Asha Pasha Shatara Pasha, this is what he's talking about. Bound by a network of false hopes, you're making decisions hoping you're going to be fulfilled, but it doesn't happen the way you expect it. Again and again. What else does Krishna say? Janmani, janmani. Birth after birth for fools. It's bad enough to be a fool one time. But birth after birth? So what exactly does Krishna mean by that? Does he mean, well, you didn't graduate from high school, you didn't go to university, birth after birth, therefore you're a fool? No, he's referring to this emotional bewilderment, this inability to make proper decisions, although we think we're so competent. Just watch yourself now, in the future, after you've heard all this. Watch yourself operate. In bhakti yoga, however, your expectations, your hopes, are always fulfilled as long as you do things Krishna's way. Let's talk about, for example, Akrura, deputed by the terrorist King Kamsa to go to Vrindavan to bring back Krishna and Balaram. You know how Narad Muni set the whole situation up. Narad Muni went to Kamsa and just told him, hey, this is what's happened. Krishna and Balaram, they're there in Vrindavan. They have killed all the demons that you sent there to kill children. Those demons were killed by Krishna and Balaram. Vasudeva just led you. Indeed, the eighth boy child was born, but Vasudeva dispatched into Vrindavan and then made this ruse that the eighth child was a daughter, causing you to lose faith in the disembodied voices from the heavens. It's all Vasudeva's chicanery. He changed you up. So, Krishna indeed is there. Balaram indeed is there. What was Kamsa's reaction? Where is that Vasudeva? I'm going to kill him. Narayana quickly adjusted the scene. No. You're not supposed to. It's not Vasudeva who's predicted to kill you. It's Krishna and Balaram. Go for Krishna and Balaram. You focus on that. That's how powerful he is. He can adjust the dials right there. But wait a minute. Not Vasudeva. It's Krishna and Balaram. They're the ones here who are going to cause trouble. Go over there. And of course, comes to listen. Oh, yes, Krishna. Yes. Narayana, the astronomer, explained. Told Kamsa, you see, if you kill Vasudeva now, Krishna and Balaram will find out and they'll flee. You don't want that to happen. You want to kill Krishna and Balaram, right? Remember that. That's the concept. Now, here's how to do it. You just merely imprison Vasudeva based on some trumped up charges. And then you invite the boys to come to Mathura for a wrestling match. That's the way to get Krishna and Balaram to come to Mathura. That's what you want. You want them to come to Mathura so you can kill them. Come to reject. Yes. Yes. This makes perfect sense. So, he called for Akrura. How did he present himself to Akrura? Akrura, I have no better friend than you in the other nights. He knows how to butter someone up. He's a Kshatriya. He knows how to divide and conquer and flatter and punish. I have no better friend than you in the Yadu dynasty. And I'm approaching you for charity. Here, I would like that you go to Vrindavan and bring back those two boys to the tour. I have a brand new chariot that's never been ridden before. A very flash, luxurious chariot. Vishnath Chakravarti Thakur described it that way. But the Thakur also points out what was Akrura's mentality in accepting that brand new chariot? occurs thinking. Not that this is a chariot given by Kamsa. Why do I want to take it to get Krishna Balaram? No. Akura knows Yukta Vairagya, how to use everything in Krishna's service. So Akura is thinking, I'm glad that this is a brand new chariot that's never been ridden on before, because I wouldn't want to take a chariot to Vrindavan to pick up Krishna Balaram that Kamsa's already sat on. Kamsa's looking at it one way. He's thinking, but when I show Akura this beautiful new chariot, he's a little simple and devotional. He'll be overwhelmed by the options of this chariot. He'll surely do what I said. And Akura is thinking something else. I'm glad no one's ever ridden on this chariot, Krishna Kamsa, because I would never agree to go pick up Krishna Balaram with a chariot that someone else, especially Kamsa, has ridden on. As Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, what is night for the transcendentalist is day for the materialist, and vice versa. It's always going to be like that. So Kamsa explains his plan. I've got some wrestlers here in Mathura. Krishna and Balaram will come. They'll wrestle. They'll be healed. And just as a further precaution, I have Kuvalalpi, the elephant. Krishna and Balaram will have to deal with this killer elephant before they even step into the wrestling arena. There's the plan. He freely explained the plan to Akura. And what was Akura's response? Akura gave credit where credit is due. Just like in our dealing with persons under the influence of mind. Can we give credit where credit is due? Very nice governmental plan. Very nice economic plan. Very nice scientific theory. Wonderful speculation. Wonderful use of imperfect senses. But we can credit where credit is due. And Akura is defending it. He said, Kamsa, your plan is excellent. But, as a footnote, it often happens in material nature that our plans, although excellent, don't work out the way we thought. Remember Kamsa's emotional presentation to Akura? See how this resonates in your bosom, where hope springs eternally. Kamsa said in his final pitch to Akura, once Krishna and Balaram are killed, I'll kill Vasudeva, I'll kill my own father, Ugrasena, who always gets in the way of my plan. I got big demon friends, Sarasandha, etc. They'll all help me. I'll be the victor, and it will be very pleasant to rule the world without obstruction. Feel that in your chest. It'll be very pleasurable to get my way, to control everything without any obstruction. This is a hidden self in us. It'll be very pleasant to have my way all the time. It'll be very pleasant when everyone recognizes that I'm always right. The world will be a very pleasant place then. This is demoniac. And comes up for the infinite. Once I do all these things, get rid of all these people, kill all these persons, even my own father, it'll be very pleasant to rule the world without any interference. This is our program, yes. You don't like to admit it, though. But just try it. Just feel in your bosom. Control, to enjoy without any intelligence. Yes. Maybe Krishna can help me do that.
I'll go to the Monday or three times. No, Krishna might give me that definition.
I can get my way without any obstruction. It'll be very pleasant indeed.
So that was Kamsa's mentality.
Akura sets off for Vrindavan the next morning. He's staying up all night because it's a Kadasi night. What is he doing? Staying up all night? He's thinking about what's going to happen when he gets to Vrindavan. He's anticipating, he's expecting, he's hoping. This is a legitimate part of bhakti because Krishna won't disappoint you. In fact, the whole chapter in Krishna's book and Bhagavatam about Akura's arriving in Vrindavan is about Krishna's meeting all of Asura's expectations, Krishna's reciprocating with Asura. So it's not that Asura is spending the whole night just working himself up into some artificial religious frenzy. No, his anticipations are part of yoga. Yoga means to connect, to link. So Asura is engaging in a very essential part of bhakti yoga, anticipating what it's going to be like when I get to Vrindavan and I see Krishna and Balaram. The Kadasi night, he stays up all night. And then he leaves the very next morning. He's so much absorbed in ecstasy, he doesn't worry about, or he didn't even remember to break the Kadasi fast. He just is on the chair, he's on his way to Vrindavan. This is Radha. He can't be faulted. Why did you break the Akadasi fast? He just said, I'm going to go to Vrindavan. I'm going to be there. I'll see Krishna tomorrow. So he's riding on the chariot toward Vrindavan. And he starts to meditate on his situation. When you think about it, how can a person like me have any opportunity to see Krishna tomorrow? Who am I? I'm such unqualified person. It's going to be like a sudra getting the opportunity to study the Vedas. My getting the opportunity to see Krishna and Balaram. How can that happen? And then he reverses. But because of Krishna's mercy, it's possible. We can also feel like that. What am I doing practicing Krishna consciousness? How would I ever have a chance to reach the culmination of bhakti? But then, you reflect upon the mercy of Sri Krishna, especially Sri Krishna Chaitanya, and you realize, I got a complete chance. It's not hope against hope. I accept Krishna's standard plan for happiness. I will get the results. Then Asura begins to reflect. Sometimes, the conditioned soul, floating in the river of time, is washed ashore. Similarly, just like a piece of wood floating in the river, is also washed ashore. In spite of the disqualification of the conditioned soul, sometimes, out of great fortune, the conditioned soul can come to Krishna consciousness. Similarly, therefore, I have a chance to see Krishna. So he just visualizing in his mind, and this is Krishna consciousness, what's going to happen when he gets to Vrindavan. You can remember so many material experiences that you've had, and you're always anticipating beforehand what it's going to be like, what this holiday is going to be like, what this acquisition is going to be like, what this marriage is going to be like, what this relationship is going to be like. This anticipation, this expectation plays a huge role in human psychology. Because it's based on the reality of the spiritual world, where anticipation, expectation is a huge part of yoga. Connecting with the ultimate source of all attraction, connecting with Krishna. So Asura is giving you a perfect example of the yoga of anticipation and expectation. When I get to Vrindavan, he's just running through the whole event in his mind even before he gets there. That's not just some kind of fantasy. It is a crucial part of bhakti yoga. He's thinking about Krishna, how he's going to serve Krishna. I'll get there to Vrindavan. I'll see Krishna and Balaram. I'll get off the chariot, offer my obeisances. Krishna will raise me up with his own hand, that hand that has benedicted so many fortunate persons. Balaram will take me to Nanda Maharaj's house. He's just running through the whole expectation in his mind. So much so that he can't tell how the day is passing and the distance is passing as he's on the way to Vrindavan. And he arrives there in the evening, but he has no conscious memory of how he passed the journey. Perhaps you can remember sometimes some intense material experience happened like that. You were longing for some supposed pleasurable event. You can't even remember how you passed the day until that so-called pleasurable event happened. I remember talking one old lady in New Zealand. And she was telling me what it was like during World War II, you know, when the men went off to the fight in Europe. And so she described how she got engaged and married when she was 18. And then her husband, not her husband, her fiancé was sent overseas to Europe to fight. And so for 4 years, she waited for his return. I actually asked the old lady, I said to her, you were very chaste, you know, you waited 4 years for your fiancé to return. She just looked at me, even though she was like 85 years old. Well, I don't understand. All the men were overseas. So I said, well, when he finally returned, what did it feel like? Yeah, I was doing some sociological research. So she said, I can't even remember the drive to the port where his ship was coming in. It is all a blur in my mind. I was just absorbed in anticipation and expectation. I can't remember. I said, what do you remember? All I know is when he walked off the ship with the other soldiers returning, I collapsed unconscious. She was so, you know, overwhelmed by anticipation that she just collapsed unconscious. So, if that can happen in material life, what's wrong with Asura having these genuine yoga experiences and offering those experiences as an example for all of you? Therefore, Srila Prabhupada points out in that chapter, Asura visits Vrindavan, that Asura is showing you the ideal way how to visit Vrindavan. You prepare yourself in your mind. You anticipate, you have expectations. And indeed, Krishna perfectly reciprocated with Asura once he got to Vrindavan. So, we have this capacity for expectation, for projection, how I'm going to feel in the future. Certainly, Asura did. I know that when Krishna lifts me up his hand, I'm going to feel this way. When Balaram takes me to Nagaraja's home, I'm going to feel it that way. I can see it all happening now. That Krishna, who is so beautiful that the goddess of fortune, Lakshmi, resides in him eternally. I know I'm going to see that Krishna. But it's all legitimate. Krishna is unlimited. And in fact, he exceeds our projections. He exceeds our estimations of how we're going to feel by doing something in bhakti yoga. Anyone who has practiced Krishna consciousness for a long period of time, you can look back and say, I never expected it was going to be like this. I was going to get all that I've been so mercifully given. I could not properly appreciate it. I remember when I was a young devotee, back in 1973 in New York. There's always these Prabhupada said going around, or later turned out not to be true. So, two of the things buzzing around was that you just stick to the process, because back then, an older devotee meant someone who was practicing Krishna consciousness for 5 years. Those are the senior lifestyles. 5 years. Now you don't consider the any 5 year devotee. So, the 5 year devotee would tell us, you just keep on taking maha every day. In 7 years, you'll have a body made of maha prasad. Yeah, that's what he told us. Wow! 7 years, I'll have a body made of maha prasad. You know, they told us, and in 10 years, your memory will be perfect. You can remember whatever you've heard, even one time. Wow! You just start looking ahead for that. Anyway, now that the disaster is ahead, as the older devotees look back, they can see, I never expected that indeed all this was going to be as it is. I could never anticipate. I can't predict. what the future bodily impact is going to be by your accepting Krishna's standard of right of happiness. It's not a fault, it's just due to the fact that you're dealing with Lord Chaitanya, whose mercy cannot be calculated. So if we keep all these things in mind as you make your decisions in life, remember Akura as an example. Remember Krishna's warnings in Bhagavad Gita, which are now borne out by scientific research. Admit how helpless we are. We're not so competent. We're not so expert. We get fooled again and again with our imperfect sense of possession. The wise person will take all these things to heart. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. So in the presence of the deity, the presence of the Vaishnava, the presence of Srila Prabhupada, and your spiritual master, you're making these vows. Whether you can properly estimate the emotional impact in the future of these vows or not, please keep those. What are the four rules?
No need, you can no investigation, no gambling, no illicit sex.
And what to do every day?
Chant minimum 15 minutes.
Yeah. All right. Your new name is Suresh Krishna Das. Okay. Control of the data, the truly pious ones. So they say Krishna. Hare
Krishna.
Sandra.
Namo Vishnu Padaya, Krishna Padaya, Krishna Padaya, Krishna Padaya, Krishna Padaya.
I don't know the second one. I don't either, I can say it. Oh, you find out from Great Krishna can tell you the second. What are the four rules?
No meat eating, no illicit sex, no intoxication, and no gang.
What to do every day?
16 rounds minimum, I should chant.
Yes. He's been associated with New Dwarka for 10 years or so. Very nice that he's taking his vows. Your new name is Neelachal Chandra. Yeah. moon of Jagannath Puri. Must be the Lord Jagannath, Lord Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Either way, you'll be okay. I think.